Welcome back. This is Mark Stein, and we're about to have a conversation with Mel Goodman. He's senior fellow at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C., adjunct professor of government at Johns Hopkins University, former Soviet analyst for the CIA and State Department, 34 years, I believe I have that right, and author of National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. And Mel Goodman will be speaking tonight at Oakland Mills Interfaith Center in Columbia, Maryland. You can get more information by contacting Ray Donaldson at rdonaldson@gmail.com. 301-776-0208. We'll tell you that again. It'll also be on our website. And Mel Goodman, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark. It's good to be with you.
So we're just kind of touching the surface here with you today, and I hope we'll have you back for a longer stay, because what you're writing is something for us all to wrestle with. But you spent – how many years did you spend working with the CIA in intelligence?
I was with the CIA for 24 years, from 1966 to 1990, and I resigned – over the politicization of intelligence in the 1980s, politicization by William Casey and Robert Gates.
And so, it's interesting. I've known a lot of other folks who have been in the CIA who are now not there, and a lot of people would say this, how could you say this, but people with a great deal of integrity, because there's a lot of internal turmoil, it seems to me, inside the world of intelligence over just what is morally, ethically, and politically correct and what is not.
That's been true on both the operational side, which is a story that's well known, but also on the intelligence side, which is not well known. But when I testified against Robert Gates in 1991, this is the story I tried to bring to the table, and I got some publicity at the time, but I don't think it's well understood, the danger of politicization of intelligence. That's what got us into war, in part, in Iraq in 2003, a very unnecessary and immoral war. Intelligence was terribly politicized.
So let's talk about what that means and what the genesis of this is. Now, you spend a lot of time in the book and seem to have a deep fondness is the wrong word, but appreciation of Dwight D. Eisenhower and in these chapters and what he had to say, because we all know about Lynch is this one quote. Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies in a final sense a theft from those who are cold and are clothed. The world in arms is not spending its money alone. It's spending the sweat of the laborers, the genius of scientists, the hopes of its children. And that's part of that whole famous comment he made about the military-industrial complex. And he actually in the beginning said Congress, but that was left out of most popular of his speech. So, but it's some of what you're talking about begins there, right?
Well, the first part, that quote comes from the Cross of Iron speech, which I think
correct.
Is just as important as his farewell address, in which he warned about the military-industrial complex. And in his own hand, in the rough draft of the speech, he wrote Congress. But when he gave the speech, he dropped the reference to Congress and told his brother, who was the president of Johns Hopkins when I was a student there in the late 1950s, early 60s, that it was enough to take on the military and industry. He couldn't take on Congress, too. But I think Eisenhower did know what the overall problem was, but he didn't make that a theme of his two terms, which would have made it easier for presidents like Barack Obama, who I think now understands the dangers of militarism, because he gave a very important speech on the subject last May in Washington, in which he outlined the needs to reduce the power and influence of the military. But so far it's just been rhetoric. There's not been a lot of operational policy.
So let's talk about that. What happened? Give us a brief history here. I mean, and where this began, this kind of militarization of the intelligence agencies, and what got twisted and turned, and because this has been a multi-decade move and change, as you outline it in the book.
Yeah. My previous book, Failure of Intelligence, goes into that in great detail, and I would argue that it started during that very brief tenure when Gerry Ford was president of the country. And his two important aides were, and this is important, Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. And
right.
Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld tried to politicize the agency. They brought in a team led by Richard Pipes, a very anti-Soviet, an ideologue, professor from Harvard University, to try to move CIA intelligence to the right, because Cheney and Rumsfeld particularly did not like the arms control policies of Nixon and Kissinger. And this story needs to be understood, because then Ronald Reagan, a few years later, named William Casey, who was his campaign director for the most part, to be the director of the CIA. And Casey was a notorious polemicist and ideologue. And this was the great spinning that was done, the tailoring that was done of intelligence on the Soviet Union, which led the CIA to totally miss the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. And that's why I testified against Gates in 91. But a decade later, here was the CIA preparing a phony national intelligence estimate on Iraq, and that estimate was then used to write a speech for Colin Powell when he was Secretary of State and gave that phony speech to the UN in February of 2003, only 6 weeks before we went to war against Iraq. So I think Bush went to war against Iraq regardless of the intelligence, but the CIA played a role by tailoring the intelligence to suit the policies. As George Tenet, the director of CIA, said in the winter of 2002-2003, that would be a slam dunk, Mr. President, to give you the intelligence you need. And that's exactly what George Tenet and the CIA did.
So, I mean, one of the things is clear, it seems clear from some of the stuff you've been writing, is that they take the situation with Secretary Powell and others. You talk about the weakening of the State Department a lot and how that's been kind of an end of the parts of the CIA, how it was shifted, especially under Bush, with the National Reorganization, Intelligence Reorganization after 2004. And so in some people might argue then that Powell acted on good faith.
I don't think he did, because Powell was against the war, and as late as August of 2002 and September of 2002, he's the one who made Bush go back to the UN to try to make the case to the international community, something that Vice President Dick Cheney really opposed. So Powell knew the war made no sense whatsoever, but yet gave that speech, which he allowed the CIA to write for him, something that his own intelligence directors told him that he shouldn't be doing. He never should have gone out to the CIA and basically camped out there for 48 hours to allow the director, George Tenet, and the deputy, John McLaughlin, to write a phony speech based on a phony estimate. So I really hold Powell responsible in part because if he had the guts to stand up, if he had the political courage to stand up, it could have changed the political debate in this country.
Hmm. So I also want to get your analysis of what the root of this is. I mean, you talk about in your chapter about Ronald Reagan, about the not just the Iran-Contra affair, but how he was kind of falsely credited with bringing down the Soviet Union. You talk a lot about what happened under Bush and this reorganization and moving ahead. But I'm curious if you could give us your analysis of what the political dynamic was that has allowed the militarization of intelligence and the politicization of intelligence.
I think you have to go back to something Eisenhower said. It's nothing he put in writing, but he did say it to his key advisors when he was on his way out of the White House in January of 1961. And he was ruminating about his 8 years in the White House. And he said to his close advisors, and this is just about a verbatim quote, "God help the United States when the people who sit in this chair after me do not understand the military, don't know how to talk to the military, don't know how to deal with the military." And if you look at the presidents we have elected since Eisenhower, they have had or rarely had any military experience whatsoever. And in the case of two recent Democrats, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, I think they were intimidated by the military. And I hold Obama partially responsible because of the number of military people he put in civilian positions. So the militarization that we've seen is in the policy community in terms of having the wrong people in key positions, and the power we've given to these military industrial oligarchs, these major firms like Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman, who have such political and economic power in this country.
So when you talk again a lot about Cheney and Rumsfeld and the roles they played, it's a fascinating piece of our history. They were also, I think, I remember the very beginning of leading up to the war in Iraq, that we did a lot of shows leading up to that, talking to many people. But these are people who, from the very beginning in their own organizations, called for this war, called for all this stuff in the very beginning. And they were able to achieve a lot because of the political power they were able to, that they received when George W. Bush won.
Well, Cheney wanted this war from the outset. I don't think the intelligence had anything to do with Cheney's desire.
Right.
Cheney wanted to create a more powerful presidency. This is something he wanted to do since the 1970s because he thought the errors of Vietnam had really weakened the office of the presidency. That's why he pushed Gerald Ford in a very right-wing direction. Rumsfeld was less enthusiastic about the war, but he saw it as an opportunity to carry out his concepts of a smaller, a tighter military situation. So I blame Cheney and, of course, George Bush, the president, for taking us into this war that has served no American interest whatsoever and has cost us $4 trillion.
So if we're living in the midst of the, also we have this kind of growth of the military budget under George Bush and the huge debt we now face that you write about, because of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but you talk a bit in the end of your book about what can be done, what can be done to change that, and I'm curious if you kind of outline that for us.
Well, several things need to be done. One is serious cuts in the military budget have to be made. We spend as much on the military as the rest of the world combined. And frankly, when you add in American allies and our close friends in the international arena, we're responsible for 75% of the military spending in the world. And that includes a Navy that goes way beyond any military necessity or military needs. And I would say the same thing for the Air Force. So the first thing to do to create real reform in the Pentagon, and you have to remember that the Pentagon itself probably has the fine motor skills of a dinosaur, so it's going to have to be done something from the outside the Pentagon. If you cut their budget by $1 trillion over 10 years, you will get them to make the changes that we need. Then you have to really get the national security bureaucracy back in the hands of civilians who are somewhat distrustful of the military and know how to talk to the military. So I'm talking about real reform of the institutions and real civilian command of the bureaucratic agencies. And I would start with the National Security Agency, because there you have a four-star general who's not only the director of NSA, who's defended this massive surveillance that we're undergoing right now, but he's also head of our cybersecurity agency. And this is too much power in the hands of a four-star general. And remember, it was Obama who put a retired Marine general in as a national security advisor.
Right.
Has appointed a series of retired generals to be intelligence czars, which I think is wrong. And he even put David Petraeus in as the director of CIA. I think Obama has learned from this, and I think he realizes he was rolled by the military in a surge in Afghanistan. And I give him credit for getting out of Iraq and finally significantly cutting back our presence in Afghanistan, even though I'd like to see us go a little faster. And to make decisions and realize the Pentagon's voice should not be the most important voice at the table.
Now, it's interesting. One of the kind of subtext throughout this your book that and ideas that fascinated me is the internal struggles going on.
I think it's been a story that's largely untold.
Right.
And the problem here is that Obama is essentially a loner. I've read Dreams of My Father twice now, and you have to remember that this is a man who's used to making major decisions on his own. I thought the decision to use military power in Syria was his decision, and then the decision to back off, which I thought was a rather courageous decision at the last minute, not to use military force and to let the military presence be a background for a diplomatic settlement. That was his decision, and it shows that he was rethinking the military issue, and I think he finally realizes that this country is war-weary. We've had two wars that have not served American interests. Thousands of lives have been lost. Trillions of dollars have been spent. And we really have nothing in terms of strategic benefits to show for these ventures over the last 10 or 12 years. So I think Obama wants to do something about this, but this is a very hard position to take on because of the culture of militarism. If you look at our movies, if you look at our culture in general, and if you look at the way we honor the military, even though we don't quite understand what the role of the military has been, and very few American families are even involved with
right.
the military.
Right.
So I think this needs to be addressed in a larger cultural way.
Well, and then you have, I mean, the U.S. Congress and the influence of lobbyists that are tied to a lot of the military industry, that are tied to a lot of the and new growing intelligence industry in the corporate world, and they don't want these changes.
Well, if you look at, say, Lockheed Martin, we have, 535 senators and House
right.
members.
Right.
They donate money to more than 450 of these people, and the person who gets the most money from Lockheed Martin is someone who's never served in the military, but he happens to be chairman of the House Armed Forces Committee, Buck McKeon of California. So this special interest, you know, of all the special interests that are important in this country, say the healthcare industry and the pharmaceutical industry, it's nothing compared to the military-industrial complex and the money they have to throw at these problems.
Well, Melko, let me just say that being with you for 20 minutes is not nearly enough, and we look forward to having you back.
I would like to be back.
For a longer segment, because what you're writing, I think, is important for us to wrestle with, and there are many things I wanted to ask you about that are intricate things you wrote we didn't get to, but we will do that. I encourage you all, if you can, to go down to, if you may live near there as well, the Oakland Mills Interfaith Center in Columbia, Maryland tonight. You can contact Ray Donaldson at rtdonaldson@gmail.com or call him at 301-776-0208. That Mel Goodman will be speaking there tonight. What time did you start?
It starts at 7 o'clock, and I'll have copies of my book, National Insecurity, available, and would love to personally inscribe them to people.
And all you got to do is just Google Oakland Mills Interfaith Center, Columbia, Maryland. You can get directions to go there. It's easy to find. Mel Goodman, we're talking about his latest book, National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy in D.C. And, Mel, thank you so much. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you, Mark. Good to be with you.
Take care. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back from this brief break at the top of the hour, we're joined by my old friend Milton Duggar and Dr. Duop. You know them here at WEA as the Doc and the Doug. We'll be right back.